tonight on Arena. Joining us, Pakistani composer and singer Aruj Aftab, and our critics give their views on the plays in this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch us live online at rte.ie/arena. The Dublin Theatre Festival has been running since the 26th of September. It's on until the 13th of October, and critics Helen Meaney and Chris O'Rourke have been to the Abbey, the Gate, Project Arts Centre and all over town, actually, and sometimes chasing their tail as to which venue they're going to go to for some of the shows. So, Helen, Chris, you're so welcome, and thank you for coming in to us. Have you some general or overall impressions of what you've seen so far, Helen?
Yes, I think it's a very good festival, and particularly the productions I've seen in the last week or so. Yeah, it just feels like it's gathering momentum with more and more openings, and of course more to come towards the end of the weekend. There's a great range of work of different styles, scale, forms. You know, yeah.
Mainly Irish, Chris, or lots of nationalities?
I think there's a good mix of nationalities, but there's a lot of Irish in there. I think as well. I think what's significant about this festival is it's the last festival with Willie White as artistic director. And I think what it's almost as if he's trying to show us everything he's done over the past number of years. And so there is a very wide range. It's a very rich festival. And I agree with Helen completely. It's definitely got stronger as it's gone on.
OK, well, we've a heap of shows to get through. We're going to start with the shows that are still on so people can still book there. So, Helen, Grania by Lady Gregory at the Abbey. This is the first stage production of a play she wrote back in 1912. And it's produced by and directed by Katrina McLaughlin, who is the artistic director of the Abbey. Tell us about it. It's the story. We'd know it from Toríoch d'Armadagas Grainne, but this is Lady Gregory's version of the same story.
Yes, yes, of the famous Toríoch, the pursuit by Finn McCool, the leader of the Fianna, of the young lovers Grainne and Diarmaid. And this is the first time that this play by Augusta Gregory has been staged, which is pretty remarkable. So it's of great interest in that sense, in its place in the history of Irish theatre. And it's being presented as part of the Abbey's Gregory Project, which is a year-long a sort of celebration of her, of Augusta Gregory's legacy as the co-founder of the Abbey at the National Theatre. So, I mean, I think it's really fitting that we see her own work, because up to now we've seen plays that are, you know, by women or directed by women, or, you know, so this has come sort of late in that project. And so, you know, it's a real curiosity to see this work. So I was really interested, having only ever read it.
So it's a tangled love story, a three-hander in the case of the love story.
Yeah.
There's Finn, who, and then Diarmaid, who was his great, I suppose, a son-like character to him. And then he goes off with the girl.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because that story has a lot of versions. And Lady Gregory's version, it takes one particular tack, which for me personally didn't quite work. I agree with you. It was wonderful. It's to see this as a curiosity, but as a play, it didn't quite work for me.
Okay, but so what's the tack it takes that you haven't seen in other readings of the story?
Well, I think there's a sense in this where it's as if the play has got this tension between duty and desire. So you have Fionn, he's the older leader. Grainne is given to him in marriage. She meets Diarmaid, they fall for each other, and, you know, we let you figure out what happens after that. But it becomes almost like a bromance versus a romance. And the whole idea of duty and desire kind of goes out of the way. And as you rightly said, this is a father-son relationship. It's not two buddies. So the tensions don't quite come together. So I get the impression, like I think Lady Gregory writes fantastic one or two act plays, but this is a three act play, which for me didn't quite come as it should. That said, there's some fantastic performances, and Ella Lily Highland as Grainne is absolutely sensational.
Now, I said that it was a three-hander in the love story, but there are two other people on stage, Laura Sheeran and Sean Boylan, and they are wandering singers. And let's hear a little from this. This is Endure.
Thank you.
That's Endure from Gráinne, which is the show that the Abbey are putting on for this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. Helen, I think you too had reservations about it.
Yes, I did. I mean, I think that's going back to that those vocalists and with singing songs composed by Carl Kennedy, the text of those songs is actually a sequence of sonnets that Augusta Gregory wrote about her great love and a love affair that she had and with Wilfred Blunt, and he later this a poet who later publishes this work, and that was a really fascinating biographical element that could have been made more of, I thought, because actually you can't really hear the words as performed, and so it's quite an operatic style, and so just the way they're delivered, we don't actually know that they are her poems until you read it in the program note. So that doesn't actually add that vital, interesting piece, and it also slows down, the singing really slows down what is already quite a static play, and it's a slow burning love triangle, and I think as well it's just hard to, given with only three characters and they're kind of stuck in it goes on for 7 years, this Gráinne, Dermot and Gráinne on the road and Fionn in pursuit. We needed something more, maybe as a directorial intervention. Now, having the two young singers, they're wearing present day dress and they're presented as essentially rough sleepers or homeless. It feels a little contrived to make that reference to our current homelessness crisis.
All right. Well, that's Gráinne by Lady Gregory, and that's at the Abbey Theatre, and it runs until the 26th of October. I'm sorry, I'm rushing you on because we have so many delights to talk about. The next one, Chris, is Star Jazzer, and that's inspired by a Sean O'Casey short story. It's a new productions, and of course, if it's a new, it must be site-specific and very immersive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is, it's an... It has all the Anu trademarks, you know. As you say, it really not only draws the audience in, it makes you complicit in what you're seeing, and it makes you have a very visceral reaction to what's taking place, which in this case is this wonderful juxtaposition of two stories. One of about a woman living in the tenements in early 20th century, and the other of a single mother in state care in contemporary period. And there's a suggestion of a familial link between the two, like this might be a granddaughter or whatever. But its main focus is on their experiences being in abusive relationships, and particularly with the idea that up until fairly recently, a woman couldn't refuse sex to her husband and what that entails. So in the first instance, it's six children that she has, and she's got to take care of them all the time. And we see this woman in the basement waiting to fill up a bucket of water, remembering when she was beautiful.
Okay, well, we have a clip of that from the Anu show. And in it, we have Liv O'Donoghue. She plays the woman, and she's in a common yard. As you say, she's trying to fill up the bucket of water, and she's looking at the stars and then begins to talk to the audience.
The kids gurgle like that. Mm. A moment before it went west. Where is it now? Up somewhere. Up there. Dodging about in heaven. Behind that bloody star, maybe. Blast that star, damn that star, Louise. I want to look at it no more.
Liv O'Donoghue there in a news production, A Star Jazzer. So, Helen, how do How does it work? How do Anu get this arrangement between the woman from the early part of the century, from the OKC short story, and how does it mirror today's situation?
Yes, yeah, so we are there with Leave O'Donoghue in the yard, and then we are all, as a small audience group, taken upstairs. It's the beautifully restored Georgian building of the Society of Antiquaries. So we go up flights of stairs into an upper room where we meet another character, the young woman played by Ciara Byrne, who's the present day young woman. And briefly they are together in the room and they overlap. And this suggestion that, you know, over the 100 years, there's a kind of echo in the young woman's experience of being marginalised and, you know, in Dublin living a very tough life, and echoing the woman from O'Casey's story. And the text here is new and is written by Louise Lowe. So it's really, I mean, I felt that that part of it is underdeveloped. It feels almost like a work in progress, whereas the beautiful scene with Leave O'Donoghue outside feels more complete and finished. So I think, you know, I thought it was interesting but underwritten, and it wasn't, I saw it on the opening and it wasn't quite clear what exactly the situation of the current young woman is. And it just didn't have the kind of clarity that you would get usually from Anu's writing. So I think we might see an extended version of this in the future.
And for you, Chris?
Yeah, no, I would agree absolutely. I felt that the Leave O'Donoghue piece was strong. I think Ciara Byrne was amazing, but there was this sense of I wanted more. I needed to know a little more. And it wasn't quite there, but it's still a fantastic production.
Well, Anu have just announced that they're extending their run of Star Jazzer until the 3rd of November at the Royal Society of Antiquaries. Now, Chris, you've been to see The Gate, to see The Agreement, as have I, in fact, a drama about the negotiations leading up to the Good Friday Agreement in 1999. And it's a production by the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Here we have Bertie Ahern, David Tremble, Tony Blair. They're all in a very small, sweaty room trying to give peace a chance, I guess.
Exactly. And I have to say, for me, this was a terrific production. I think as a piece of political theatre, it's funny, it's insightful, but it's more West Wing than political thriller, if you like. It's more, you know, give peace a chance, give my head a peace sort of vibe to it, where it has this wonderful, respectful irreverence. And basically the story is it was to celebrate 25 years of the Good Friday Agreement, and it looks at the days leading up to the Good Friday Agreement, which has a risk to it, because what you have is people who are there, it kind of resurrects those old excitements and, oh, is this going to happen or not? For people who weren't, it might feel a bit dated. But theatrically, it's so brilliantly done. It whisks around. It's hugely fast. Some of the scenes, like there's one in the urinal where they do three different versions of a possible meeting. They have one where it's like a dance scene with Tony Blair. So they add these things in, and then this beautiful scene between Bertie Ahern and Mo Molin, where they're arguing as politicians but come together as people. And the whole idea that these sworn enemies looking to find a way to live together in the same space is something that's incredibly relevant for today.
And the performances are great. Like, a lot of the time, they don't look... Bertie Ahern, the actor, doesn't look like Bertie Ahern, but you believe it.
Exactly. I mean, Tony Blair is exactly a case in point. You go, he's not Tony Blair, but whatever he's doing, I'm just loving it, you know, because it is Tony Blair.
Great, thank you. That's The Agreement by Owen McCaffrey, and that's at the Gay Theatre until the 27th of October. Helen, you saw Safe House, a song cycle written by Enda Walsh and composer Anna Malarkey at the Peacock Theatre. Now, we have a stake in this because they came together at an arena show. Enda had been thinking of a song cycle. He heard Anna at a Galway Arts Festival show we did and approached her about working together. What is the show?
You see, great art begins here again.
I know.
It is, to call it a song cycle might sound quite formal, or, you know, but it is an absolutely multimedia immersion in sound, film, music, recorded music, live singing, design, and you know, it's I think a really exciting new piece from Enda Walsh and Anna Malarkey and all his Enda Walsh's regular collaborators, you know, a lighting designer Adam Silverman and so on. And it is every part of it is technically superb, and it is very all-enveloping experience to see it. I saw it last night at the project. Sorry, and it's Peacock.
Peacock, yes. And it's the story of a young woman, like a distressed young woman in a ball alley in the west of Ireland.
Well, it's really a series of fragments of her own memories. So we're in her mind, and therefore you cannot say exactly what is true and what is half-remembered. And it's about her, a very difficult childhood, yes. In the west of Ireland in the late 80s and 90s, which were, you know, God knows, a terrible time to be a young woman growing up in many parts of this country. And she is, there's a background of alcoholism or neglect from her parents or her mother. Again, that's not clear. And then we see her growing up, and Kate Gilmore is brilliant at moving from child to adolescent to adult. She leaves home, goes to Dublin, the big city, and things don't really quite work out as she'd hoped.
Let's hear. This is The Road. It's the second song in the cycle, and it establishes where Grace is, marking the junction in her life. That's at the Safe House. The Road is the name of, that was the song from the second cycle in the songs from Safe House at the Peacock Stage. And that runs until the 16th of November. Chris, you went to see the Druid show. It opened in Galway, mm-hmm. but of course it was here in the Gaiety. And it's Tom Murphy's play, The House, which has been produced in Dublin before. But this is the first time Druid Theatre, who have this long relationship with Tom Murphy.
And it shows. It is a magnificent revival. It's absolutely fantastic production. I think the House, for people who may not be familiar, it's set in the 1950s. It follows these couple of guys, particularly this one individual, Christy Kavanagh, who return home for the builder's holiday week, couple of weeks, just to show off how well they're doing. And kind
we're
of
set
find
in the 1940s, 1950s?
1940s, 50s, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they belong neither here, but they belong, don't belong either way. But Christy has a particular connection with the Burka family, who would be more well-to-do, who have this big house, which is being sold. And he sets about buying it. And then all sorts of complications ensue. So even from that little bit, there's a lot going on. And I think Gary Hines does a phenomenal job in directing this, because it's like playing a concerto. There's so many little phrases, so many little notes. Like, there's one, for example, very early on, Marie Mullen as Mr. Burka, Marty Ray as Christy Kavanagh, and this conversation where you see her wanting to believe him, him trying to be better than he is, but him trying to be a little kid. And there's so much going on. And that's repeated many, many, many times throughout. So it's one of those productions where you surrender to it rather than being dragged along by it. And it's absolutely terrific.
OK, Helen, you went to Fish Amble. That's Jim Cullerton directs a new play, Breaking, by Amy Kidd. We had Amy Kidd in. It's a very ambitious play and very unusual play.
It is. It's really ambitious formally, especially as it's her debut. And you know, great that she's been taken up by Fish Amble, and the play's been published by Methuen, so that's marvellous. It's tackling the subject of coercive control, and also non-consensual sex, or we might call it rape, within an intimate relationship. But that's the central subject. But the way she structures the play is extremely elaborate and intricate. It's almost like a game where she flips the actors playing the couple. Charlie and Sam are played by all of the actors in different combinations of gender. They're diverse in all sorts of ways, so they keep their own accents, whether they're playing male, female, or non-binary, and it's becomes quite an intricate sort of puzzle, almost.
Right, and words coming out of the mouth of a man may sound different than those coming out of a woman. Is that what they're playing with around
those questions? And I think it's deliberately challenging us as audience about our assumptions about two women in a lesbian relationship. A man and a woman. Do we have a different perception of, say, power dynamics, particularly when you throw money, one person having money and the other not, into that? And they've moved in together very hastily. And it really is a brilliant, in the beginning, observation of how coercive control develops from kind of emotional manipulation, and then gets worse and worse and turns to violence. So that aspect of it, I think, is a genuine education and is disturbing. But then there's further tricks with the structure and the form, where we actually start to play some of the scenes backwards. And so some of that impact is diminished, I think.
Well, let's hear a clip from it. Here, Sam and Charlie are having an argument, and there is some strong language.
I don't like your family, Sam. I'm sorry, but I don't. They're stuck up. You don't like them either.
I do like them. I love them.
That's not the same thing. You can love someone and not like them.
Yes. Yes, I know, you can love someone and despise them. I'm not disputing that. You can really fucking hate the people you love sometimes.
I didn't ask for the thesis, Sam.
Sorry.
You're doing it again. You drank too much.
You drank more than I did.
I can handle it.
There you go. That's
Curtis Lee Oscar.
Yes, so that's Curtis Lee Oscar and Evan Gaffney, and they're both in Breaking. So overall, would you recommend it, that one, Helen?
I really enjoyed it up till about halfway through, and you have to admire the cast and the director for how they achieve the complexity of it. I do think playing the entire play backwards was a mistake.
The entire play backwards.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. Okay.
Halfway through.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're seeing scenes in reverse. Now it does add certain levels of nuance to scenes that we've seen before, but that stops actually having that enriching effect, as we just get sort of slightly bamboozled by the same conversations over and over again about, you know, do you love me? Do you love me? That's the, you know, how much do you love me? And if you really loved me, would you not do X? And I think that's a shame, actually.
So that's Breaking by Fish Amble Theatre Company. Chris Michael Keegan Dolan now, and he's Dance Theatre Company Chuck Dowsa, creators of Mom. They are so big and so popular at the Dublin Theatre Festival. They opened the festival with No Bo Daddy at the O'Reilly Theatre. So this is a very different kettle of fish to Mom.
It is in many respects. I think you're right. I think a lot of people who went on the back of Mom might be a little disappointed here, because it's a lot slower. It starts off, it takes a very different approach, mainly because it's a story that looks, the name Nobodaddy comes from a William Blake character, and it looks at some of the horrors in the world, and it has this idea of, you know, striving towards hope. And particularly around themes of death, there's the murder of the Miami Show Band in 1975, that's referenced. Mike and Keegan Dolan's own mother died recently, and that's referenced. There's references around hospitals. So there's this kind of darkness pervading through it with a lot of humour, but there's a lot of singing.
Yes, because they did a collaboration with Sam Amadon, the folk singer.
Exactly, to the point it looks like a Sam Amadon concert with choreographic support at times.
Oh, you don't think there's enough dancing?
Well, the last it ends out with roughly, I think, about three songs by Amadon and a poetry recital. So the dancing is amazing when it's there, but I didn't feel we got enough of it.
Okay, so that's, I'm sure Nobodaddy is over, but I'm sure it will be back.
Yes.
Helen, guest host Stranger Ghost.
Yes, new play by Kate Heffernan, a really clever, I thought, ingenious, just piece of kind of fugitive vagabond theatre that's being staged on the sets of other plays during the festival earlier in the day and moving around different theatres, different venues throughout Dublin. And that is completely thematically linked to the subject of the play, which is about house sharing, strangers trying to negotiate space, and these three people living in the house of a woman who's very elderly and is actually living in a nursing home, and they're living in her house almost like squatters, even though they're paying rent. So this is drawing attention to the rental crisis, the housing crisis, the way people are forced to live in shared spaces that they wouldn't necessarily choose. It's witty, but it's also got a very kind of eerie atmosphere, directed by Owen Carrick. I found it charming and also slightly disturbing and sad, actually.
So I'm so sorry now, we won't get to Cupid or Signal to Noise, which I know you both wanted to talk about. But Helen Meaney and Chris O'Rourke, thank you so much for reviewing Dublin Theatre Festival's wonderful array of dramas. And there are still shows available to go and see, so check out the website. Pakistani-American composer, songwriter and vocalist Aruj Aftab will take to the stage at the National Concert Hall as part of their Perspective season. She will perform tracks from her latest album Night Rain as well as her Grammy Award-winning album Vulture Prince. Aftab's musical style blends classical minimalism, new age electronic trance and jazz structures and has won her many fans, including former US President Barack Obama and Elvis Costello. Aftab's new album Night Rain is filled with original songs inspired by the night and her experience in the New York City creative scene. I'm delighted to be joined by Aruj Aftab on the line from New Orleans. But first, let's listen to a track from her latest album, Night Rain. This is Ai Nehin. There you go. That's A. Nehain, performed there by Aruj Aftab. And you're very welcome, Aruj, to the show.
Thank you so much, Heike.
Hi. Tell us about that song. It is so distinctive, yet it is obviously one of your songs. Tell us about it and how it relates to the night, which is really the theme of Night Rain, your new album.
Actually, Ai Nehin is kind of one of my favorite songs on this album. It has, of course, the night theme. There's someone who's waiting for their special friend to come visit, and that person hasn't arrived yet, and so the protagonist is kind of wondering where they are, and they're just sort of saying out loud these speculations, like maybe you know it rained on the way, maybe there was a storm, you know, maybe night fell before they could catch the road, you know, maybe they broke their leg, you know, like it starts to get you start to realize that, you know, this person is not really, it's kind of like a clandestine meeting, you know. As the song goes on, you start to realize a little bit in hints and the tone of the lyrics that and the music intensifies itself too, so you just start to realize that like somebody's waiting for someone who they technically shouldn't really be even meeting, and that person is kind of is not there. So the lover is growing impatient, and it's just one of those things that is very characteristic of, you know, just one of those nuanced sentiments of things that happen at night.
Yes, because, and what has made you so attracted to the night? Is it the time of day you've always loved, or was it something specific recently that has sent you into the darkness?
Well, I think it's all with musicians that, you know, we're sort of night people, and the way they call jazz musicians cats is because, you know, cats are prowling around at night. Like, we've always had the night associated with our being and our, like, the way we are in the world. And I really like that. That's all. It's just been present forever. And I wanted to think of, I wanted the music to have a running thread that was simple, but also I would be able to dig deeper into it, and the night is definitely that, you know.
I think
it doesn't matter where we are. Sorry, go ahead.
I think you said that in this album you wanted to be a little flirty and crazy, and I guess flirty and crazy is the way people can get late at night.
Yeah, definitely. They can definitely get that way at night, for sure.
Yeah, and it looks like if this guy ever turns up, that might be what will happen in the song as well.
That might maybe not be what will happen since the other person's been waiting for so long.
Yeah, good telling off. So are the lyrics in that Urdu, and then how did you create the soundscape around those beautiful lyrics?
Yes, the lyrics are in Urdu. It's so hard to describe how the soundscape was then created, because it's just something. It's a process that doesn't really have a process, you know.
Do you come with the words, or is it a feeling or the music first?
Well, for me, it's really important that the music is able to be as dramatic and cinematic and you know, conversational. It should have a real sense of wording itself. Like, the music should have the content enough that conveys what the lyrics are saying, because I am aware that a lot of the people who listen to my music don't necessarily speak or understand Urdu. So for me, the emphasis is, surely I do spend a lot of time on the arrangement and the instrumentation and what each part is doing. Like the drum and percussion arrangement in the song is, I spent a lot of time figuring that out. And yeah, musically, I did want it to be kind of like in four movements, like the first opening movement where, you know, the scene is set and, you know, this person is waiting and we don't really know anything about her or who she's waiting for. And then in the second section, when there's the guitar solo, you know, we're starting to realize that it's about a journey. This person is maybe in a different city even, you know. Then we hear the thunderclaps, and then we start to hear that, you know, she's now kind of a little pissed, you know. It's just so they'd all kind of, the lyrics and the melody obviously kind of dictate the story. And then musically, how to convey the story, how to be a mirror of that is the tricky part. And I always hope that I've done it right.
Now, I know you're no fan of the word fusion, and I know that, and it's hard. How would you categorize your music, this very strong South Asian sensibility, with then the use and the collaboration with all the Western musicians that you do?
I try to focus on the idea that it should feel well, it is personal, and that it should also feel natural, because I am someone who has just spent time and energy in so many different places and in so many different musical styles, and them coming together, they come together in my head in a really obvious way, that feels very personal and very, you know, reflective of who I am, you know, and so that's what I try to do. And it's definitely, fusion is an old word. It's definitely a word that serves the function of it. You fuse things together, but I think there's something about the organic and truth to this blend that sets it apart.
Yes, and I think in your album Vulture Prince, which won you a Grammy Award and 3 Grammy Award nominations, that this was kind of, you know, I've got it. I've got how I can be very much myself while being out in the world working with other musical forms.
Yes, I would say that's true.
So will we listen to the Mohabbat, which is from that album, and we'll maybe talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
Aruj Aftab there performing Mohabba from her album Vulture Prince. That album, which brought you success and a following, is very different in tone to your more recent album. Do you see, I don't know if it's a progression or a movement, maybe. I know there was an awful lot of songs about grief because you were singing about the fact that your brother had died. Do you see a difference in tone now in your new album?
Yeah, I think that I believe that as artists, everything that we make is a reflection of who we are in the current moment. And I think it's actually quite important to do that as an artist, to have that in the forefront of your creativity, because it brings in a certain degree of honesty and also a certain degree of vulnerability and a certain degree of pride, you know, for what you've endured and or who you continue to become. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And as an artist, I definitely, you know, prioritize that, or I think that it's important to know and to be aware of who you are in the moment when you're writing new music. And so, yeah, it's, you know, Vulture Prince was pretty, you know, it was steeped in grief and loss. And Night Rain is more of a celebration of life, and it's more mature as an artist. You know, I'm just growing and I'm exploring, and there's so much music in me. I'm just really excited to keep moving forward and have the privilege to keep putting out work.
Now, you're coming to the National Concert Hall on Sunday, and I'm sure people will be delighted to hear songs from both your albums. But I think they will be very happy to hear the track Whiskey. You might talk us into that before we play some of it. You're bringing it back to Ireland.
Yeah, I hope to also be able to sample a bunch of Irish whiskies because they're my favorite. I feel like the afterhang after the show is going to be really fun. But yeah, I love whiskey, and the song is not really directly about whiskey. It's kind of about being, it's another moment that happens. It's another thing that happens on some nights where, you know, you're out with someone who you're attracted to and you drink too much and you don't know how to get home. You know, it also is a little bit of it describes a little bit of the effect that whiskey particularly does have on the people who like to drink it. So it's also a love song to the whiskey itself.
Well, let's listen to Whiskey.
Gets heavy and rests on my shoulder, 'cause you drink too much whiskey when you're with me. Your head gets heavy and rests on my shoulder, 'cause you drink too much whiskey when you're with me. To give in to your beauty and let you fall in love with me. I think I'm ready to give in to your beauty and let you fall in love with me.
Whiskey there from Aruj Aftab. And Aruj will play the National Concert Hall in Dublin this Sunday, the 13th of October, as part of their Perspective series. More details on nch.ie. In the wake of the global protest movement Like Roads Must Fall against historic monuments erected to slavers and colonists, cultural institutions around the world are grappling with the contents of their historical collections and facing up to tough questions around colonial history, how certain artefacts in their collections were attained. Irish institutions are not immune from this kind of introspection. A new documentary called Irsme or Remnants will be broadcast tonight on TG Cahar at 9:30. It explores how Irish museums and universities are coming to terms with items collected or stolen on their behalf, and the complex decisions around what to do with these artefacts, including whether they should be returned to where they came from. Damien McCann is the director of Irsme, and he joins me now on the line. Damien, it's a fascinating topic, and a topic that we rarely think comes home here to Ireland, being a country that came under colonial rule ourselves.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I think the first time that the first place where the idea came from was that the producer of the documentary, Jeglin O'Mahain, was looking up, you know, doing a bit of research on Ulm stones. And some of the Ulm stones that he was looking into were held in the British Museum. And of course, his first thought was, why are they in the British Museum? How did they come to be there? And I suppose the bigger question, should they be there in the first place? And so I think that sort of started our journey, certainly in terms of then digging a wee bit deeper and finding out, in the first instance, Irish objects that are abroad, And then, you know, when you start looking internally, well, what objects are in this country that perhaps shouldn't be here, and how did they get here in the first place?
Yes. Now, the story of the Inishbofin skulls is a fascinating story. Bring us into this.
Yeah, so the story of the Inishbofin skulls, they deal with 13 skulls that were stolen in the 1890s by two men, Alfred Haddon and another guy, Dixon. And effectively, they were on the island of Inishbofin, and while they were there, they pretty much stole this group of 13 skulls, well documented. They kept diaries as to how they did it and brought it back to the mainland, and then they've ended up in Trinity. So they've been there for, they were there for 130 odd years.
And were Haddon and Dixon working for Trinity College at the time? Like, were there, were they serious archaeologists?
Yeah, they were associates of Trinity College, and Haddon eventually ended up in Cambridge University. But all around that time, there was a kind of, there was this whole thing about anthropomorphics and anthropometrics and craniology, and, you know, this idea of you could measure skulls to find out, you know, where people came from. And that was all part of that process. In Inishbofin, they were measuring skulls, and that was the reason effectively why Haddon and Dixon brought the skulls back. It was all part of that movement.
So then it was the people of Inishbofin themselves discovered this and have been fighting to get these skulls back.
Yeah, there was a journalist and writer, Kieran Walsh, had kind of uncovered this story effectively and had seen the skulls himself while he was working in Trinity. And I think some of the islanders then had read the research that Kieran had done around how they came to be there and were shocked that they were there. And then that's what started, a very long process in order to bring them back to the island. Now, certainly, when we started filming was kind of early on in the process. The first day of our filming was the day that Trinity went out to the island for the first time to meet the islanders to discuss kind of next steps. So, you know, from the time we started filming until the time the skulls went back, it was 2 years past. So it was a very, very long journey to get there.
So Marie Coyne is one of the activists on Inishbofin, and she's an islander and a campaigner. And here she reads Haddon's diary account of how the skulls were stolen and smuggled off the island.
"We all went ashore together that night, and you provided us with a sack. And later in the dark, he took us close to the church. Coast being clear, Dixon and I climbed over the gate and went down the enclosure. In the corner, by dim light, we saw the skulls in a recess in the wall. We put our spoils in the sack and cautiously made our way back to the road. The two sailors wanted to take the bag from Dixon, but he would not let them. And when asked what was in it, he replied, 'Poaching. No one on the steamer except our two selves have been any idea that there were human skulls in a steamer, and they shan't know either.'"
Marie Coyne there from Earsmead, the documentary about decolonisation, I suppose you'd call it. Then there is the story of the Inishbofin skulls. When then they started negotiating with Trinity, and this is mirrored in other examples you have in the documentary, the whole process is quite frustrating because it does take a long time. And this isn't due to Trinity necessarily pushing back, but it's kind of the process they go through.
Yeah, I mean, Trinity's a big organisation, and they have their own, as you say, process that they have to go to. You know, I mean, I think there are two things. There's one that, you know, there's the kind of intellectual look at these things, and then there's the emotional. And from from Trinity's point of view, they have to, you know, look at all the provenance, they have to look through the diaries, they have to make sure that the right thing's happening, the right objects are going back to the right people. Whereas, you know, I suppose when you're with the islanders, then it's very much an emotional thing. You know, the feeling is, you know, why are those skulls there, and how do we get them back? So I think that was the length of the process was because of that. You know, Trinity had their own work to go through in terms of the research. And that's really what we were looking to see when we started the documentary. The idea was to see one of these processes from start to finish. And look at why it took so long, and what are the things that are going on behind the scenes to to make that happen effectively.
Yes, and there was also an aspect of the Colonial Legacy Project was looking at whether the Berkeley Library in TCD should be renamed, and we heard today that it will now be called the E. Van Boland Library. So, mm-hmm. so institutions may be slow, but they are at least willing to engage with the legacy of the past.
Yeah, I mean, Trinity themselves have their own group there, the Trinity Colonial Legacy Project. And you know, they initially, I think it was a 2-year project. There were three of them working on it. And that was really the two big things that came up for them, their kind of centerpieces to what they were going to look at. One was the Inishbofin Skulls, and the other one was denaming the Berkeley Library, both of which came to pass within that 2-year period. So, the hope is that there'll be more off the back of it. They were, you know, both successful and rightly so. So I imagine maybe they'll continue that work. I mean, also this idea of decolonizing, you know, you get a lot of people, you know, when we were making the documentary, people saying, well, where does it end? And the point is that it never ends. You keep going. You keep looking and re-examining and you know, places like this, rightfully so, that's what they should be doing.
Well, Damien McCann, thank you so much for talking to us on Arena tonight. Damien's documentary, Ears Me, will be broadcast tonight on TG Cahar at 9:30. That's it for tonight's show. The show was researched by Paula Shields. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buckless was on sound. The programme was produced by Pauline McNamara, and John Creedon is next.